There we go.
Okay. Take two. I would like to welcome you all to the Board of Directors meeting for Student Success Program Nonprofit Board, which operates the O'Dale Charter Schools and the Charter Schools of San Diego. I am Len Herring, Chairman of the Board, and I will facilitate this meeting. Let's take a roll call first. When I call your name, please indicate an A or an A. If you're not here, you can't do anything. Anyway, roll call. Myself is I. Scott.
Aye.
Barton.
Aye.
David Cream.
Aye.
Tim Morton.
Aye.
And Eric Schweinfeld.
Aye.
Did I mishear or did you say Audeo?
Excuse me?
Did you say Audeo Board?
O'Dale Charter Schools.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, thank you.
And Mary, is there anybody on the call that needs to be introduced?
I think you know everyone, Melia.
I think we do. I don't see anybody else joining.
Nope.
We went through the roll there. Okay, item 1 point, we're moving on to item 1.3, consideration of approval of adoption of board findings pursuant to Government Code Section 54953 Echo 1. The SSP Board of Directors determines in accordance with the Government Code Section 54953 Echo 1 Bravo, that meeting in person would present an imminent risk of health and safety of attendees. Pursuant to Government Code Section 54953 Echo 3, the board has also reconsidered the circumstances of the state emergency declaration declared by the governor on March the 4th, 2020, and finds the state of emergency continues to directly impact the ability of the directors to meet safely in person and or the state of location officially continue to impose recommended measures to promote social distancing. Additionally, AB 361 requires that this finding be made every 30 days to continue to permit teleconferencing meetings without adhering to some of the traditional requirements of the Brown Act, specifically with teleconference requirements of Government Code Section 54953 Bravo 3. Do I have a motion to approve item 1.3?
So moved, Tim Morton.
Very well.
Green, second.
Thank you. We will now conduct a voting roll call. Myself, aye. Scott?
Aye.
David?
Aye.
Tim?
Aye.
And Eric?
Aye.
Next is item 1.4, establishment of a quorum. Do I have a motion to approve?
Moved, Barton.
Thank you. We have a second.
Second, Morton.
We will conduct a roll call. Myself, aye. Scott? Scott?
Aye.
Thank you. David?
Aye.
Tim?
Aye.
Eric?
Aye.
Very good. We will now conduct the Pledge of Allegiance. I can ask everyone to stand. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Okay, moving on. We'll move on to item 2.0 is public comment. Public comment for the items of interest to the public within the scope of the Student Success Programs Board non-agenda shall be no longer than 2 minutes. Public comment.
Admiral, do we have to approve the agenda first or not?
No, this is for public comment. We'll go to the next one.
Okay.
Items will be no longer than 3 minutes. Speakers may not yield their time. Any person who wishes to make a comment on either non-agenda or agenda items shall use the raise hand feature of Zoom to notify the board. In accordance with the Brown Act, no discussion or action may occur at this time, but it is the board's prerogative to respond and give direction to the staff. All public comment will be heard at this point in the agenda as ordered below. Each agenda item being commented on will have a maximum of 20 minutes. allotted, and each non-agenda item will have a maximum of 10 minutes allotted. If necessary, I may equivocally decrease the time of each speaker in order to stay within the allotted maximum. Item 2.1 is a non-agenda public comments. This is an opportunity for members of the public to speak to the board on items not on the agenda. Speakers will be limited to 2 minutes per speaker, and the items limited to 20 minutes in total, unless otherwise modified by myself. Speakers may not yield their time. Are there any public comments on items that are not on the agenda? Okay, hearing nothing and seeing no raised hands, we'll move on to item 2.2, agenda for the public comment. This is an opportunity for members of the public to speak to the board on items that appear on the agenda. Speakers will be limited to 3 minutes per speaker. And this item is limited to 20 minutes unless otherwise modified by myself, and speakers may not yield their time. Are there any public comments on the agenda items? Okay. And different from the rest, this is a training meeting, so the only item on the agenda is the training session. So moving on, hearing no public comments or seeing no raised hands, I don't see any raised hands. We'll move on to item 3.0. 3.1 is Young and Minnie.
All right, excuse me, we need to approve the agenda, please, just like Ms.
Teams. Yeah, I didn't see it here, so. Can I get a motion to approve the agenda, which is the board workshop?
So moved.
And a second, please.
Morton, second.
Okay, we take a roll call for vote. Myself, aye. Scott?
Yeah.
Scott, you there?
Aye.
Okay.
Okay.
Yep, got you. David?
Aye.
Tim?
Aye.
And Eric?
Aye.
Great, thank you. Now we move on to item 3.0, which is the agenda that we're all here for. We'll Young Mini Core Law Firm will provide training to the board regarding professional development training, including best practices in charter schools, board management updates on the Charter School Act, and a review of corporate practices, fiduciary duties, and fiscal oversight, the Brown Act, and conflict of interest laws. Thank you. We'll go from here, and I will turn it over to Paul.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for the time today. My colleague and I, Kayla Haidu, here as well, are going to split up the slides this morning. We're starting part one of a two-part series that we'll cover today. And Kayla, you can remind me of the second date that's coming up for the second part. But we're, you know, the goal with this time with you today, both to answer any questions you might have that you think of as it relates to charter schools in general, but we'll take you through a high-level overview of the, you know, charter schools, charter school landscape, a little bit of the history of the Charter Schools Act, and then drive into some of the more critical issues that are facing charter schools these days, and talk about laws that you absolutely need to be aware of and cognizant of every year. Just, you know, the Brown Act and changes to the Brown Act, which is the state's open meeting law, and the state's conflict of interest laws. And then we'll talk a little bit about current cases and trends and where charter schools are going in the state of California, again, as well as answering any questions that you might all have. Let me share my screen so I can put our PowerPoint presentation up here. If you could let me know when I'm hopefully sharing the right screen. And then, all right, so you all should be seeing the PowerPoint presentation. Good, thank you, appreciate that. Just a little bit of background for those who board members who know us, but maybe some of the other staff members who have not have met us. But our law firm has been in business for, you know, going on 30 years now. The Charter Schools Act is approaching 30 years old. We have partners with a collective 150 years of experience working with charter schools, and we have 33 attorneys who just work with charter schools throughout the state of California. But we also do some work in Arizona, now Tennessee, Texas, Nevada, a little bit of Washington, one school in Oregon. But mainly because we focus on charter schools, even within our organization, we have people that do employment and labor law, special education exclusively, nonprofit, litigation, audits, charter development, et cetera. So we're broken up into teams. And we've been in business long enough, we represent a little more than half or more of the state's active charter schools. And we do, like we're doing today, we conduct a lot of workshops and trainings and webinars for our charter school clients and through the California Charter Schools Association and the Charter Schools Development Center each year for people who are attending those conferences. Feel free again, anytime, just to jump in. But taking it at a beginning and basic level, what it means to be a charter school, just a little bit of background here. The Charter Schools Act, as you might all recall, passed in 1992. It actually took effect in January 1 of 1993 and was a legislative bargain, or I should say legislative negotiated settlement. Instead of pushing for the voucher initiative, the legislature decided to settle on being the second state of the United States following Minnesota to be able to have a Charter Schools Act. And the basic bargain behind the Charter Schools Act was that everybody recognized that the education code was growing and growing and growing, and it was thousands and thousands of code sections and proscriptions and prescriptions, and was essentially becoming unknowable to most school district superintendents, and a very barbaric, complex, tangled weave of laws and regulations. And the idea was that that was sapping the energy and creativity out of public education. So the Charter Schools Act was intended to say, look, we will set aside that tome of law and give you the ability to operate a school more or less free from legal compliance, which we will talk about extensively coming up, but we will require you to show academic improvement. So tell us what you're going to do, how you're going to educate the kids, and what kind of outcomes you were going to produce. And in exchange, we'll take away all the legal rules and regulations and proscriptions and prescriptions that were inhibiting schools' ability to operate. That was the basic bargain almost 30 years ago, and we'll tell you how that's been changing over the years. Charter school life cycles were going to be approval, 1 to 5 years, renewal had to be 5 years, and anytime during those 5 years, the charter school could be revoked if it failed to produce those outcomes, if it violated law, if it violated its charter, or if it engaged in fiscal malfeasance. The main parts of the charter, the primary main part of the charter was academic accountability. Again, the first three elements of the charter right up front had to be the educational program, the methods and types of assessments, and then the third element was going to be the types of outcomes that you were going to produce and how you were going to measure them. Charter school legal compliance is another huge part of a charter school's operation, and it has grown. Initially, you mainly had to worry about complying with your charter and a very small subset of education code rules and regulations. But as I'll talk about throughout our time together throughout this workshop, unfortunately, this bullet almost could be on top of academic accountability. The legislature, who can't help themselves, has pushed more and more laws, rules, and regulations on charter schools to the point where legal compliance is almost more important to school districts than academic accountability. But you can't survive and you can't operate unless you're fiscally solvent. So charter school fiscal solvency and budgeting and being able to budget in public school finance, which is incredibly difficult year over year, as you as board members know, because of the very odd and strange way charter schools are funded, the way we receive federal funding, the delays in funding. And as we'll talk about later during some of the cases, you might actually find out afterwards that you're not actually going to be funded for students you've enrolled. And then you have charter schools in this very strange world where you operate as a nonprofit public benefit corporation. So you have one foot in the private world and you have another foot that's in the public school world because you operate a public school with public money under the public's purview. And subject to many public laws like the Brown Act, conflicts of interest, et cetera. So there's a slide coming up where I'll talk about the main distinctions between the nonprofit world and the world in which you sit also as a charter school, as a public school. So in your structure, in your organization, you are, as you know, a nonprofit public benefit corporation board. You have an articles of incorporation that establish your existence and the specific purpose of that corporation. It dedicates your assets. You have bylaws that dictate how your board comes together and operates. And those bylaws prescribe where you meet, how you meet, who's on your board, how you remove board members, what kind of committees you can have, how are your committees selected, et cetera. And those are outlined in your bylaws. So again, core documents that you should all have access to would be the charters, the Charter School of San Diego, and making sure you've got a copy of your articles of incorporation and your bylaws available as well, because those are documents that you will refer to frequently. As a nonprofit public benefit corporation, you have a restriction on the number of interested persons. It's interesting that, you know, nonprofits in the state of California can have up to 49% of their board can be made up of interested persons. And interested persons are those who are being paid by the organization, or who have been paid by the organization in the prior 12 months, or who are in a union with, married to, or otherwise with someone that's also being paid by the organization. But as we talk about in the conflict of interest provisions, the conflict of interest laws in the public world that apply don't intersect well with this law and arguably prevent what the nonprofit law allows, which means that under the conflict laws, you're more or less prevented from even having, employees on the board. Your director's terms are outlined in the bylaws here, 2-year terms, which you can renew for 3 times in a row for up to 6 years. And they outline how board members are removed, which can be removed by a majority of members in a vote in a regularly scheduled meeting. And you have 2 people that can join your board. You have granting agency representatives. So the code allows a charter school that operates as a nonprofit public benefit corporation, the granting agency, and here if you had multiple granting agencies, you might have multiple representatives, to place a representative on your board. Now, it is not typically done. There's only a couple places in the state of California right now where a school district is putting someone on a board. Oakland, for example, we have a couple clients in Oakland Unified School District where the district has elected to put someone on the board. The reason why it's not typically done is because under the law, a charter school operating as a nonprofit insulates the granting agency from its debts and liabilities. Assuming the granting agency performs its oversight function in accordance with law, which is actually quite minimal, then they are insulated from the debts and liabilities of a charter school, which in 30 years, no charter school that has failed and had debts and liabilities, lawsuits or bankruptcy or whatever, has the granting agency, the school district, had to absorb those liabilities. If you put a representative on your board, you increase the likelihood that someone might try to lawyer, might try to argue that the granting agency should be responsible for those debts and liabilities because the granting agency's representative was involved in decision-making as it relates to the school. Your bylaws also outline, as I mentioned earlier, the voting of the board. A quorum is a majority, and then you have majority of the quorum takes action. Here, we make sure that the bylaws also dictate that the board members are non-compensated. I apologize in advance, but it's actually an enormous benefit for you all because volunteer board members in the state of California for nonprofits have the highest level of immunity in law. And it is very, very rare, and I've never seen it in the charter school world yet, that a board member of a charter school operating as a nonprofit that is also volunteer has been found liable for any debts and liabilities. Now, you doesn't mean you can't be named in a lawsuit. You can, but it just means that I can get you out of a lawsuit or any liability very quickly. And then also you have immunities in the bylaws where the board can grant additional immunities and hold harmless, and you have directors and officers insurance to cover a board member and officer liabilities. Every nonprofit has to have 3 officers. You have to have president, secretary, and a treasurer. And we outline in the bylaws the alignment of those terms with the CEO founder, for example, here is the president, because that's the day-to-day chief administrator officer of the organization, but you also have a chairperson of the board. So your titles are chair of the board, your president slash CEO, secretary and treasurer as well. And then, as I mentioned, the bylaws outline the indemnity of the board members. So there's one of the questions that we get asked a lot, because there are not a lot of good models in the public school world, is what's the role of the board versus the administration of the school? What's the role of an individual board member versus the rest of the board? And what is the best way for a charter school to operate? And a lot of this, which I'll talk about here, is both 30 years of hindsight, but also others in the field nationally, including your CEO, Mary, who's written extensively about successful charter schools and charter schools, how and why and how they fail. There's Brian Carpenter, you may have heard of him, who has his PhD, and he studied, 300 charter schools that have failed and why. One of the main reasons where charter schools go wrong is the board and the administration don't understand the difference between management and governance. Where the management is left to the administration of the organization, the governance is performed by the board. I'll talk a little further in a moment on a slide about, governance being the same level, since we were talking about football earlier, of what the owner of the team might be responsible for doing, is setting out the broad policies and goals and the long-term objectives, win the Super Bowl or whatnot. Management is done by the people they hire, say the coach, down on the field. The owner of the team typically doesn't call the plays. They're not the ones that are recruiting the players to perform the services. So that's a very important distinction. A lot of schools, especially smaller, maybe we'll call them mom and pop type shops, where there's a lot of just parents running the school. They don't have a big school. They don't have a lot, they have a high turnover. The board tends to get into the management of the organization. They tend to try, you can see it in their agendas. They tend to try to make a lot of the decisions of who to hire, who to fire, changes in curriculum. And those are things that you, and you'll see as we go through these slides, you leave to the organization to decide. The board's primary role, hire the CEO, outline the long-term objectives of the organization, and then you hold the CEO accountable. You have that one point of contact between the board and the administration to hold the organization accountable for how well it's doing. That leads you to the next bullet here. How well is the question the board should ask itself? How will is the question that the administration is asking itself? And so if you're having something, you're thinking about the board's role, again, you can say it's board's function is to determine, how well is the administration performing towards the goals that have been set? How will it do those things is the function of the administration itself. The avoiding administrivia is kind of a function of the first two bullets, which is if you're getting into what color the bathroom should be painted, you're into the weeds. And, again, I think you all know, because you've been on this board for a while and I've been around this board for a while as well, you don't function that way. But I just point that out here because there are some schools that do get down into that level of detail and they're missing the bigger picture. Now, individual board members have very little function, role, or responsibility outside a regularly convened or properly convened board meeting. Outside of board meeting, regular convened board meeting, they don't have any individual authority unless they have been directed that authority through a board vote. Now, you could have individual board members that are asked on behalf of the board through a vote to attend a conference and report back. That's fine. Or to go out and develop information to report back to the board, but individual board members don't have any authority to speak on behalf of the board, shouldn't be answering questions by media, shouldn't be, making broad policy statements or social media statements. And these are all things that we see, unfortunately, that board members do, especially if they're board members in the minority of a decision of a vote that they disliked about the organization. So one of the primary things that you can see is a dysfunction in charter school land is where you have a fraction on the board and you have minority board members who are out there talking to parents and social media and blasting the rest of the board. They're not respecting the decision of the majority of the board, which is the next bullet point, which is key to understanding the democratic process of how boards operate and how they operate effectively and efficiently. You may not always agree with the majority decision of the board, but the majority decision of the board is the one that controls. Now, here you have excellent track record of establishing almost always, I believe, unanimous decision-making of the board and developing consensus around moving forward, which is absolutely terrific. Another role of the board and board members is to adhere and understand conflicts of interest, which we will cover in the upcoming slides in the next session. Conflicts of interest, make sure that you as an individual board member are making decisions that are always in the best interest of the organization and not yourself. So it can be financial conflicts or it could be personal conflicts of interest. If one of you, again, had a child in the school and the issue and consideration was coming before the board was something related to your child's teacher, it is probably a conflict of interest for that board member to be involved in that decision just because of their direct connection to the issue before them. But mainly in the high level decisions and cases that we'll talk about where there's been prosecutions and criminal and civil liability have been in the area of financial conflicts of interest. And almost always where somebody frankly was trying to help the school, but did so in a way that got themselves into trouble under the conflict of interest laws. And then board members have, each of you, including the upper level administrators, have fiduciary duties to the organization. Duty of loyalty and duty of care cover a little greater detail under a corporate slide, but generally the duty of loyalty, always to act in the best interest of the organization, and duty of care to always exercise the highest level of care as it relates to decision-making for the organization, making sure you're asking the questions of the people you need to ask, lawyers or experts or financial people or academic people, assessment people, to be able to understand the decisions you're being asked to make. The four areas and the next two bullets that are your primary roles and responsibility: academic accountability. Academic accountability still is the number one thing. What does our charter say we are going to produce by way of academic results? How well are we doing achieving those academic results? And then I always have to ask the question, because it's always a changing field of acronyms, is what are we using to measure those results? How do we know? What's the baseline? What test are we using? How does that relate? How do we compare locally? Because a lot of the decision-making in California around renewals is going to be, how are we doing compared to the local school district? How are we doing compared to schools with the same demographic makeup? Although this is different for you because of the way your schools qualify under these rules. And then how are we doing academically throughout the state of California, comparative fashion? And then fiscal oversight. What's our multi-year fiscal projection? Do we have a balanced budget? You guys have operated in a way that you've always got solid fiscal accountability, solid fiscal audits, sufficient and well done reserves to be able to handle economic uncertainty, et cetera. And then legal compliance is next. And you're looking at and answering the questions of, what do we need to do? Board trainings, professional development, et cetera, stay on top of changes in the law, making sure that we're aware of what, handling complaints and concerns that are raised to the organization swiftly, working with your insurance carrier, et cetera. And then safety. These are the areas, again, academic accountability, fiscal oversight, legal compliance, and physical safety. What is the physical safety issues and concerns, if there are any, as it relates to pupils and staff? How are our facilities? Are they safe? Are they well-maintained? Do we have proper insurance, et cetera? And I know your organization does, again, a phenomenal job in all those areas. And then the board can have a high-level function in complaint processing, which is to be able to address any complaints that are not resolved fully by the administration, or if there is in your policy, typically, if the complaint is about the high-level administration, the complaint comes to the board, so there's typically a function there of addressing complaint processing. And if there were lawsuits, lawsuits are typically either brought and or defended by under the direction of, at the highest level, by the board. Let me go back to one slide. I just wanted to on the nonprofit, the difference between the nonprofit and the charter school and the charter school operating as a nonprofit, because I know some of you sit on nonprofit boards. So the key similarities for what you're doing here and what you might be doing on another nonprofit board would be your fiduciary duties of loyalty and care. That's the same. Your need to make money to exist, that's the same. Your need to monitor legal compliance, same, obviously different laws, but again, same function as a board member. And in both cases, at the highest level, you're under IRS scrutiny, and you want to make sure you're complying with the rules and regulations that apply to nonprofits, or you could lose your tax-exempt status. Some of the five key differences here, though, for you would be, one, your nonprofit is tied to existing charters, which have a term. So whereas a normal nonprofit has perpetual existence, and your nonprofit does have perpetual existence, its function is to operate charters. So if the charters themselves are revoked, effectively the underlying function of your nonprofit is not there. So you have to be aware that you have these five-year terms, or in this case, because they've been extended because of the pandemic, in which you have to seek renewal. Also, unlike a normal nonprofit that has a specific purpose and goals and objectives, your charters are, in the eyes of the law, more or less a contract that dictate accountability, as I said, student outcomes, and they do limit certain actions of your organization. So again, it's the charter, I would say you could equate it to a contract or a law or a constitution that does circumscribe the actions of your organization. You have a level of accountability to outside organizations that does not exist. A nonprofit is generally accountable to the IRS and to the California Attorney General. Here in the state of California, you also have that, the IRS and the Attorney General, but you also have your granting agency. There's oversight even by the County Board of Education of that granting agency, and by the California Department of Education and the state controller in the state as well. Most nonprofits receive private sources of funding and donations and grants, et cetera, and all the money is private, and you're not subject to open meeting laws and don't have to produce public records. But here you're 99.9% publicly funded. So your state and federal monies are coming in, and because of that public funding, the other state's public laws of transparency, which we'll talk about, the Brown Act and conflict of interest, apply to you. And lastly, I think the main, again, core difference between typical nonprofits, your Red Crosses, your other local charities, and charter schools, the charter schools are a political beast. They're controversial still in the state of California, nationally. You can see it every day if you pick up the papers. There's been, in 30 years, it's been a wild swing of enthusiasm and support to a renewed focus in some sectors on, you know, anti-charter, pro-labor movement. And then I think I see the pendulum swinging back the other way. We see more and more parent support of choice and charters. There's been a large movement and influx of students away from regular K-12 education into the charter school segment. And we see a little growing support in California and at the federal level. And one third of the legislature is turning over in 3 weeks or at the end of the year. And a lot of the people that were opposed to charter schools and produced some of the worst anti-charter legislation that we have are not renewing their terms at the state legislature. So there's a big difference between, you know, watching that at a state and local level as well, what's going on, and how you know, the things we need to be aware of. So fiduciary duties, just to elaborate a little further, duty of care. Duty care requires you to act in a manner that's reasonable and informed. So I know you all do, you get your agendas and your board packets and the backup documentation, you ask questions, you have the right to ask for further details about anything that's presented to you to review or to decide on. And again, if that meant getting further information about assessment, accountability, your test results, your financials, legal compliance, any of those areas I listed, physical safety of the sites, any of those areas, you have the right and actually must ask for information so you make sure you're making informed decisions. Duty of loyalty is to act in the best interest of the organization at all times. If you're sent to a conference on behalf of the organization and find a terrific money-making venture that you think the organization could benefit by, this is a terrible example, but you would be under the duty of loyalty. You'd breach that duty if you took that upon yourself and used it for your own personal benefit. If you, duty of loyalty would require you to actually take that, come back to the corporation and say, here, I've got this great idea you should use, you know, you should license this new thing and do this thing. So that means acting in the best interest of the corporation at all times, even if it means, dividing from your own direction or personal interest on an item. So you have a series of continuing legal obligations as a corporation, which you've seen, you know, again, in your other nonprofit world. You have to file annual statements of revenue and expenditures in Form 199s and Form 990s. You have statements of information which delineate who's on your board and officers of your organization. And when we get to the conflict of interest slides, we'll talk a little bit about the Form 700 statements of economic interest that require you to disclose certain financial interests, real property interests, business interests and positions, et cetera, that might be impacted by the decision-making that you make as a board so that members of the public can monitor and determine whether or not you are in any way, shape or form breaching your duty of loyalty and your or violating the conflict of interest laws in the state of California. The Corporations Code, which overlines and outlines the nonprofit that you are, has required you to have an annual corporate meeting and elect your officers. You have to create and maintain minutes and maintain your minutes as you do. And you have to maintain your corporate records. All the filings that I mentioned on the previous page, your bylaws, your articles of incorporation, et cetera. So that's the kind of the lay of the land. Let's talk a little bit now, unless anybody has any questions, about your organizational design, which you all know, but is not unusual, but changing in the state of California. You have two primary nonprofits that you operate under the Altus Schools model. You've got the Adeo Charter School Corporation, and you have student success programs. You operate in a collaborative, cohesive fashion, which we'll talk about in a moment. You have the two and the original, the OG, the Charter School of San Diego, and Adeo Charter School under one nonprofit, and you have the other six charter schools operating under the other nonprofit, separate boards, separate organizations. Those lines down the middle are purposely not touching because technically they are two separate legal organizations operating under one intellectual property name, the Altus Schools. And so this is important because, and I don't think there's any question about this, Altus Schools is not a legal entity. And I think there may be, you know, someone may not understand that when they drive up first and see the name on the building, but you all understand that it represents a philosophy, a system of practice that's been put under the umbrella and the name and the intellectual property rights of Altus Schools. It's owned by SSP. Each nonprofit operates independently, governs their respective charters in accordance with their charters, bylaws, fiduciary duties, et cetera. So that's just an important distinction to keep in mind if anybody asks you or you were to talk about how does you are board members of SSP, how does that fit in the overall structure of Altus Schools? And say, well, we're the board of one nonprofit, of two nonprofits that are collaborating together under the umbrella of Altus Schools. So as you know, we have a written agreement between the two organizations, they're referred to as an MOU or a collaboration agreement that delineates three areas primarily, facility sharing agreement, because SSP owns the primary physical assets that form the Hunikins and Bonita site. And then there's the intellectual property agreement because SSP came first and the intellectual property of Altus Schools, the trade name, the logo, et cetera, is owned by by SSP and is licensed to ADAO for their organization. And then you do have employees that work between the two organizations. Not, they work separately for the two nonprofits. They're not jointly employed. And we'll talk about that as well. So while the practice has been well-defined and lawful, San Diego did ask that we memorialize some of those things which I've just talked about so others could, so they could see it and understand exactly how we were operating this. But here are some things that recently were clarified. You have in your bylaws the right of a parent representative on your board, which you've had the annual process for looking for someone who wants to be on your board. There's clarification regarding the DOJ clearance, which is that Department of Justice requires anybody who is working in public schools that might have direct contact with students to go through fingerprinting and background clearances. It's even if one of the employees between ADAO and SSP works in both organizations, they have to be fingerprinted and cleared twice, once each in each organization. Just to be clear, the benefits, health and welfare benefits, between those employees working for SSP and ADAO Corp are the same. So we compared them across the line. Everyone was, sick leave, vacation, health and welfare benefits all the way down the line, just to show San Diego that they are the same. We clarified that while the law, the nonprofit law, allows for employee board members, if they were to want to serve on either ADAO or SSP, and while actually there's a specific carve out in the conflict law to allow a charter school to have an employee board member, we clarified that we would not have employee board members on the board. It's probably a better practice. Because frankly, if you have an employee board member on the board, the conflicts that we'll talk about later go to the employee, not to the organization. So if there's a problem, the employee can get entangled in issues. And so it's just better for the employees that they don't do that, because it's sometimes a little hard to understand where the lines are drawn when you're being paid by the organization and you're on the board of the organization. There's a division of confidentiality and access to records between the two nonprofits. So those records of personnel and those student records that are only related to SSP's business are not and should not be shared with the ADAO Inc. folks unless they are, there's been waivers and approvals for that sort of thing. And then we have contracts with between the two corporations, and then individual corporations have contracts with all corporations that they do business with. There's a policy that was recently approved that talked about the timing of board meetings and the commitment to have board meetings one board meeting at least a year in the evening. And that any consulting contracts that were to involve assisting schools outside the Altus Schools Network would be approved by the board. That employee contracts, the policy there talks about the fact that we have employee contracts between the two nonprofit corporations to distinguish, to make it very clear. I know some of you received two paychecks as a result of that. There was clarification in the work travel policy around reimbursement for travel expenses, who approves travel, where things that are prohibited for expenses for travel, and clarification regarding the fact that email addresses provided by the organization are specific to the organization and they should only be used for business work, not personal work. And that the organizations, because one nonprofit has 6 charter schools and the other nonprofit has 2, and some employees work between the two, that budgeting of the employee's time in one nonprofit between the separate schools will be done by the senior team, and that it can be done on enrollment, number of students, certain types of reports, maybe the number of special education students, et cetera, what best approximates the amount of time that the employee worked on the various functions for the various schools or between the two nonprofits. Real estate transactions, it clarified that the board will be responsible for approving new leases, new purchases, but that renewals of leases, et cetera, and other fiscal issues come to the administration. You retained a compliance officer. And this is really a sign of the change of time in 30 years, right? Compliance officer's main function is around legal compliance. And it's, we see charter management organizations, which is a term to describe any charter school nonprofit that operates more than one charter. So both ADEO and SSP technically are charter management organizations. And then collectively, you refer to them as a charter management organization. And when you have that many granting agencies and that many different charters, it's a good idea to have a compliance officer watching, making sure that everything is done consistent with the various rules and regulations. And then we clarified that the Altus School service mark, the trade name, the logo, the imagery, the art that was being used is that owned by SSP and being licensed for without fee to ADEO to use within those schools. This slide memorializes a lot of things that I just talked about on the last slide. If anybody has any questions around these policies, happy to go through them in greater detail. So in sum, before we turn to the Brown Act, and turn this over to Kayla, the seven habits of highly effective boards. You know, what is the defining proper role of the board versus administration? We talked about governance and management. The board's role is to, how well do all parts of the governance team know their roles? You know, do you understand your lane, so to speak? And I would say, score of 1 to 10, 10 being the highest, your organizational structure gets 10s across the board. You understand the board. I can look at the agendas. I can see the board meetings. I can see what the board's being decided, what it's doing. And it's the sticking to the strategic levels, long setting term goals of the organization is exactly the way the organization operates efficiently. And it's reflected in the tenure of your organization, the success and tenure of your organization. We talked about the coach versus the owner, what is governing versus managing. And the administration governing the organization, as the coach is doing down on the field, the board managing, although this is probably a college football team, so that's not, I should replace this with an NFL team so I can stick with that earlier description of an owner versus the coach. So the board's role to establish and enforce operational norms as a board and making sure that they stick to it. Again, you do an excellent job with that. When is board approval required? You've clearly delineated and even clarified further in some of these policies when the board approves things, when the administration approves things, when the administration approves something, the board will later see it. You do an excellent job working through your agenda, and you rarely have a situation where the board is divided. If there were a circumstance where the board is divided, or if there were even further questions, I've seen the board work through and ask further questions in order to arrive at a consensus. And as we said, the board members' basis for voting should be based on complying with their duty of loyalty and duty of care and making sure that they understand everything that they're being asked to decide that's before them. And key is, acting with one voice. So the board acts through majority decision, and typically only the board chair or the administration on behalf of the board will answer questions to the press, will report out what's going on. So we act with one voice. So we have that one point of contact between the board, typically the administration, and individual board members, if not the board chair or not asked about the function they've been delegated, typically should deflect any questions by the media, parents, employees, et cetera, back to the board chair or back to the CEO of the organization for a response. And you can say unequivocally that it's that you can't speak to the issue and that the organization functions most effectively when they have a single point of contact for answering those questions. And actually, we've seen, unfortunately, many schools where the one or more board members try to get involved and respond to complaints and concerns. And so they get themselves involved and they go and they go to the administration. They may even go down to the school site and try to fix it. And then what happens? Well, first of all, they create dysfunction. Secondly, they become the complaint center. Then every parent who has a complaint starts emailing that individual board member to try to get a response. And now you've got parents bypassing the administration and going directly to an individual board who can't actually speak for the board as a whole. Understanding and, you know, and utilizing your time effectively as a board. You're doing a great job. Your agendas are prepared, distributed well in advance. You know, the public is given clear instruction on how they can participate in the agendas and the materials and on your website, in your meetings. You spend most of your time in your meetings on the high-level functionality of your board, including things like today, doing professional development training. I've never seen anybody come to a meeting that's not fully prepared. And you know you have a healthy board when you've got the high level of decision making and functionality that you have, and you don't have discord, and you don't have meetings that run 6 hours, 7 hours long like we sometimes find, where there's just a lot of fighting and you have a lot of complaints going on. Number six, develop professionally. So you're doing that today with the training and the other training that we'll be doing. And if you have in the past or would like in the future, we can provide information that's can, you know, Mary Lynn and Tim, et cetera, about other ways you can develop. There are online training modules. There's wonderful conferences. I don't know how many of you have been to the, you know, the California Charter School Association annual conference or the Charter Schools Development Center conference annually, but those are also terrific ways to develop professionally as well as to connect with other board members, you know, that are operating and working charter school landscape. And, you know, one of the major areas that trip up charter schools in the state of California is a failure to comply with the state's three transparency laws, Brown Act open meetings, that's one, conflicts of interest, two, and Public Records Act. And we'll talk about the first two for sure. The third, Public Records Act, just as a quick note, is the third leg of the transparency chair that says that all records of the public agency are subject to inspection, but delineates exceptions to that. And you know, you as an organization are repeatedly asked to produce public records. I know they go through a process internally. There's a 10-day response and a 14-day response, and then records have to be produced. And your organization is doing that with a high level of transparency. Take just a quick breather there, and then we can turn it over to Kayla to talk a little bit about the Brown Act. Mary, or board chair, any questions? Kayla, you want to jump in?
Yeah, sure thing. Do you want to let me share my screen, or are you going to do the click?
I'll change the slides for you if you want, sure.
Okay, sure. All right. Hi, everyone. It's Paul mentioned. I'm Kayla Haydu, senior counsel in our firm's Walnut Creek office up here in the Bay Area. And for the next many, many slides, I am going to go over the Brown Act. And the Brown Act is all the laws that govern the process and procedures that you all have to adhere to in every meeting and even in the days before the board meeting and in between the meeting. So it's a big deal. There's a lot to cover. We're going to cover six big questions, the first three of which are up on the screen here today. First, what is the purpose of the act? Because, of course, understanding why this act exists and why it was implemented helps contextualize all of the various provisions and generally can just lead to a better, clearer understanding of the act's many nuances, some of which are new, which we will chat about. The second, what constitutes the meeting? This one, of course, is important too, as understanding what actually qualifies as a meeting enables you to understand when you are required to actually follow all of the requirements that we'll discuss. Third, what are the notice meeting? What are the meeting notice and agenda requirements? Fourth, what are the public's rights at meetings? And spoiler alert, they have a lot of rights. Fifth, those rights are not without limits. There are permissible closed sessions, so we'll go over those that allow you to understand when you can actually exclude the public. And finally, what are the penalties and remedies for violating the act? And if it is, you know, sometimes boards do make inadvertent errors. So we go over this section with you just so you know what to expect in advance of any compliance issues, should anything come up. Let's dig in. Let's go to the next slide and answer question one. What is the purpose of the act? Generally, the purpose is that we have in bold here is just to foster the broad public access. The Brown Act is one of those laws that is in the spirit of sunshine and public access, public transparency. And I always think it's helpful to think about that fundamental purpose here and what we do in each meeting. The bottom line is that the Brown Act serves to allow the public access to your meetings and input into the decisions you make. It basically provides a mechanism by which members of the public know what you're planning to discuss so that they can prepare. And then they can participate in some limited ways about the conversations that you do have during those meetings. Next slide. But at the same time, public access is not absolute. So it's something to think about in terms of structuring your meetings and agendas is where those nuances actually lie so that you can determine when confidentiality is allowed and is expected despite this general scheme of and presumption around this public transparency. So there are, of course, these closed sessions, which we have listed here. And this is just a snapshot list. We'll go over these in more detail later, but it's personnel matters, labor negotiations, real property negotiations, receiving legal advice from your school's attorney, public security, and pupil discipline. So we'll talk a little later, as I just said in this presentation, about what exactly is required in the context of closed session to be compliant, and also what exactly these various things mean. But outside of these areas, you can assume that public access is required and that the conversation is not subject to closed session and proceed accordingly. Question number two, what constitutes a board meeting? So we have just this basic definition here. A meeting occurs when any congregation of a majority of the members of the board meet to hear, discuss, deliberate, take action on any item of school business. So it's a basic general definition that, as you can see, is pretty broad. Even if you're not taking action, even if you're just discussing, deliberating, of course, that would still constitute a meeting. Now, there are some exceptions to that, as we'll see in the next slide. Certainly, and Paul just actually mentioned a couple of these, the majority of you can attend a public conference of general interest. That might be the Charter School Development Center conference, one that Paul mentioned. Could be the A+ conference, which I know is happening just at the end of this week. Both are just examples. A majority of you could also attend another public bodies meeting. And this is something that we see really often. If one of your charters is up for renewal, for example, a majority of you might show up at a school district meeting or a county board meeting to see their board's discussion of your charter and of that renewal. And if you make a public comment at that meeting, which you can do, other members of the public can be there and they can hear what you have to say. So you're still meeting that transparency threshold. Also, ceremonial gatherings, think graduation, think award ceremonies. The major caveat with all of these being that school business cannot be discussed. You cannot talk about school business. Otherwise, you risk it constituting a meeting. On the next slide, we'll talk about committees. The general rule is that the Brown Act does apply to subsidiary committees of the board. There are very few exceptions to this. And by the way, it does not matter what you call it. You can call it a task force, you can call it a commission, you can call it whatever you want, but the Brown Act does generally apply, as you'll see here, commissions, committees, boards or other bodies of a local agency, whether permanent or temporary. So even if they're just around for a couple months, decision-making or advisory, even if they're just giving advice, not actually making any decisions, created by ordinance, resolution or formal action of the body are subject to the act. Now, there are some exceptions to the general rule that the Brown Act does apply. And these exceptions are here. Advisory committees, though not decision-making, composed solely of the members of the board that are less than a quorum of the board, are not subject to the act unless it is a standing committee, so it's not just temporary, which has continuing subject matter jurisdiction, or a meeting schedule fixed by ordinance, resolution, or formal action of the body. What I want to say to you here on this is, if you need to create a committee for any reason, perhaps you need buy-in from not only board members, but some of your parents, by all means do it. Do what you think is right. Do what your school needs to do. Just know that the committee likely is going to need to post an agenda and follow the Brown Act, because these exceptions are pretty narrow. Let's talk about serial meetings. They're prohibited under the Brown Act because they're basically the exact opposite of what you're supposed to be doing as a legislative body. And what is a serial meeting? This does trip people up. This is anytime you've got a majority of the board members outside of a meeting using a series of communications of any kind, directly or through intermediaries, and you're discussing, deliberating, taking action on this, that's that same language that we heard before, any item of school business that is within that subject matter jurisdiction of your board. And where we see this become an issue the most is with technology. So technology can result in so-called meetings at a time you might not expect. Think about emails, texts, social media, web postings. So just be careful there. And then one other thing I'll say about intermediaries, I think that this most often comes up in a different context, but which I'll discuss in a second, but an intermediary is simply someone that you have specifically tasked with conveying a message on your behalf, of course. So if I were on a board and I went to my husband and I gave him a message and said, okay, now you go tell all the other board members how I feel about this one school issue, that would, of course, be the same thing as if I just picked up the phone and called those other board members and told them the message myself. So they're not a way to get around these rules. Additional limits already up on the screen here on board communications. This is the limit on sharing board opinions and positions outside of agendized meetings. So while an employee or an official can engage in separate conversations, communications outside a meeting with other members of the body in order to answer questions or provide information regarding a matter of school business, that person may not communicate to members of the board the comments or position of any other member of the board. That's the intermediary thing that I was just talking about. That being said, you as members of the board are expected to uphold a duty of care. And ultimately what that means is that you can and you should ask questions about items you have. If you have questions of staff, for example, or your administration, you can ask them those questions. Now, the administration, when asking those questions, they absolutely have the right to do that. They can answer any questions that you pose. The only thing the administration cannot share is the comments or positions of other members of the board. So they cannot say, for example, okay, I just got off the phone with Paul, and I know Paul agrees with you on this issue, because of course that's then essentially using them, the administration, as an intermediary. We'll go to the next slide. Okay, teleconferencing. In terms of teleconferencing, this is an area that has received the most changes under a bill just recently signed by the governor. So it has been the most confusing area under the Brown Act because we have changed the rules multiple times. And they're going to change again come January 1st, 2023. So in just a few months, we'll chat about it. But first, these are the regular, normal teleconferencing rules. These were developed pre-COVID, pre-virtual, pre-remote era. And even though these rules that I'll go over right now are more onerous than the current COVID era rules, They are still in effect. So if you want to follow these requirements for teleconferencing, you can and you may, and you would be in compliance. So regular teleconferencing rules have six additional comments in addition to all the other Brown Act stuff. First, the agenda must be posted at all teleconference locations. So that means that if you are teleconferencing in from a hotel, you have to post the agenda at the hotel. And also vitally in point number two here, you also have to include each specific teleconference location. So the address of your hotel, and then also the room number where you'll be doing the teleconferencing so that members of the public can participate in the meeting. They can come to your room where you're doing this if they so choose. Also, next slide. All votes in the teleconferencing world have to be taken by roll call. So just keep that in mind. Number four, and each location has to be accessible to the public. So think there about ADA compliance. If you're teleconferencing from the second story of your house, for example, and like most of us, if you have two stories, you have stairs and not an elevator, that can be problematic for ADA reasons. Number five, members of the public must also be able to hear and must have the right to address the board directly from that teleconference location. So that's like what I said, you know, they can come to the room where you are conducting your meeting from and participate with you there. And finally, a quorum of the board under these rules must participate from within the charter school's jurisdiction. And jurisdiction typically just means the county or counties in which your school or schools are located. So those are the six normal teleconferencing rules. They have been in the Brown Act for years and years and years. Then, of course, March 2020 came around and everything changed. So during the pandemic, Governor Newsom used his authority under the Emergency Services Act to waive most of the requirements, most of those six requirements that I just discussed. He did so through executive order. Now, that executive order expired about a year ago. It was September 2021. And what the legislator did is they replaced that with AB 361. Now, AB 361, I'll just read it to you here and then I'll kind of summarize it. So pursuant to this, the charter school board may continue to hold teleconference meetings without adhering to some of the traditional requirements of the Brown Act, those six requirements that I just read, if certain conditions are met. The agenda does not need to provide notice of each. So if certain conditions are met, this is what you can get away with. The agenda does not need to provide notice of each teleconference location. They do not need to be posted at each location. A quorum of the board members do not need to be located within the charter school's jurisdiction. And the governing board members may participate in a teleconference meeting from places that are not publicly accessible. So essentially what this says is that a charter school board may continue to hold teleconference meetings without adhering to those six requirements that I just discussed, if certain conditions are met and renewed every 30 days. Now, all this is true, we'll go to the next slide here. All this is true only if you're adopting the appropriate findings. So you have to make sure, I think we'll just click it one more time, there we go. You have to make sure that you're adopting the appropriate findings. And in addition to that, these other things have to be in place. There does have to be a proclaimed state of emergency. This one's important. And there does in California remain this proclaimed state of emergency due to the pandemic. So even though the governor has scaled back a lot of his executive orders, this declaration of emergency because of COVID does remain. So you are good there. And then in addition to that, there either has to be one or either of these two things. State or local officials have imposed or recommended measures to promote social distancing, or the charter school board has determined that meeting in person would present imminent risk to the health and safety of attendees. So you have to have the proclaimed state of emergency and then either or of the second thing. We'll go to the next one. Now, there's a number of things that the legislator wrote into AB 361 to continue to protect the rights of the public, the rights of people in light of these increased flexibilities. Most of these are not rocket science and are pretty self-explanatory, but there are two that I want to draw your attention to because we have seen schools struggle with these. The first is in bullet point 3, allowing members of the public to access the meeting. Of course, you know, you give them the Zoom link, you have that on your agenda. But importantly, what has been tripping some schools up, not you all though, I heard it on your agenda today, describing the manner in which the public can offer public comment. So if they want to offer a public comment, do you want them to use the raise hand feature of Zoom? Do you want them to write it in the chat? We recommend that schools have it in their agendas like you all do, so that people know how you want them to behave and they know what to expect. And then telling them in that meeting, like Admiral Herring did today, if you know, if the public wants to make a comment, they can use the raise hand feature of Zoom to do so. You've specifically then provided that how you want the public to engage with you during meetings. And then the last one is timely. I know this state had rolling blackouts this summer. So if there's a technical disruption, say the power goes out wherever you're broadcasting, you have an issue. You need to be careful. Do not take any further action until the public access is restored. The others, I'll just quickly go down. You have to, of course, continue to protect statutory and constitutional rights. You have to give notice and post agendas as otherwise required. You don't have to add those increased specificity about where you're teleconferencing from or what room you're in. And you don't have to have the ADA compliance, but you do have to give just the general notice and post the agendas. You don't have to, you cannot require members of the public to submit comments in advance. So they have to be able to participate in real time during your meeting. And then you also need to provide a timed or reasonable period for public comments so that the public can engage should they want to, and they don't feel like they're super stressed and have to get their Zoom hand raised ASAP. All right, next slide. Now, assuming that you are going to use this AB 361 flexibility, as I've mentioned a couple times, the board has to take action to renew this every 30 days. And then as we've also, in that renewal, you have to reconsider the circumstances of the state of emergency. And then either of the following circumstances exist, which we already talked about. It has to directly impact the ability of members to meet safely in person, or there have to be these state local officials who have continued to impose or even just recommend or promote social distancing. All right, let's go on. Okay. So I said we are going to change the teleconferencing rules again, and we are going to change again. So this is a new law. It AB 2449, it was just signed just over a month ago. The first thing to emphasize under these laws is that they do not take effect until January 1st, 2023. So everything that we're going to be talking about in the next several slides will not be applicable until the start of the new year. This, frankly, is a complicated bill. It is, there are a lot of requirements to exercise the flexibility that this bill allows. And when January 1st comes along, if you are going to use AB 2449, we suggest that you review these slides as your school is getting ready to post the agenda. It's complicated, but let's walk through it. The first thing to keep in mind about this new teleconferencing scheme is that it's only available for two reasons: personal emergencies and for just cause. And the statute helpfully expressly defines what those mean. And I'll go over that in just a little bit, but know that either of those circumstances must be present. And so then when there is a personal emergency or there is just cause, this bill does allow for teleconferencing requirements to be relaxed, as it says here, It allows teleconferencing without any obligation to identify the teleconferencing location on the agenda or allow public access to that location. However, and this is a change, the member must participate through both audio and visual technology under this exception. So they cannot, for example, I've seen this happen in board meetings I've been in before, a board member's on the road, and therefore they're only participating through audio. That would not work in this circumstance. We have to hear them and see them in order for this to be allowed. And next slide. Again, this flexibility is only available in the case of just cause or emergency circumstances and can only be exercised in a limited degree. The first one, for a just cause situation, it can only be used 2 times per calendar year per board member. So that's, you know, only twice a year for each board member. The other one can be used with some increased regularity, but there's a more global cap, which I'll chat about in a second. Also, for emergency circumstance, if one of the board members does have an emergency circumstance, the governing board must actually take action to approve that emergency circumstance request. So it would be approving the request to appear the teleconference in to be remote. And the board, in taking that action, has to provide just a very, very general description of that item. So you don't need to disclose exactly what the emergency is. I don't suggest that you do. You don't want to risk disclosing any personal medical information in that description. It can be very general. This person has an emergency circumstance and therefore will be appearing by audio and video. So while the first one for just cause does not require board approval, as I said, it is limited to 2 times per calendar year per board member. This one does, this emergency circumstance one, does require board approval, but it doesn't have this 2 times a year cap, although, as I just said, there is this more global cap, which we'll discuss in a couple of slides. All right, definitions. The definition of emergency circumstance simply means a physical or family medical emergency that prevents a member from attending in person. And this is pretty vague. It doesn't require anything like hospitalization or any like necessary severity bar. And that ambiguity gives you some flexibility as board members to determine for yourself what constitutes an emergency circumstance. And then for just cause, it can mean one of several things: childcare, caring for another, you know, maybe a parent, a partner, or spouse, a contagious illness. You don't want to spread your sickness to other people. Need related to a physical or mental disability that is already defined in the law, but is for some reason not otherwise accommodated. And then also, this travel one's kind of interesting. It's travel, but only while on official business of the governing board or of another state or local agency. So just cause is more explicitly defined. Emergency circumstance does have some more ambiguity there. Now, teleconferencing based on emergency under these rules does require that the member make the request to participate remotely as soon as possible, that the member make a separate request for each meeting. So it can't just be, you know, I have this longstanding emergency, and so I am just, you know, going to do this for the foreseeable future. You need to do it for each meeting. And then the third point is helpful here. If the request does not allow for sufficient time to place the proposed action on such a request on the posted agenda, the legislative body can still take action at the beginning of the meeting. So no worries there. Now, this is the global cap that I talked about. For both the just cause and the emergency situation, board members have to keep in mind that under no circumstance can any board member participate under this law remotely for more than 3 consecutive months or more than 20% of the regular meetings within the calendar year. So you'll want to calculate the number of board meetings you have and then figure out what 20% would be. And then, or more than two of the meetings, if the legislative body meets regularly, fewer than 10 times per calendar year. So it's pretty restrictive. And there are a lot of other requirements as well, similar to what we've seen under the virtual meeting requirements in the pandemic era, SB 361. I think if we go to the next slide, we can see those. These are not necessarily as they are imposed in a traditional teleconference meeting where we're actually allowing the public access to our vacation or in our house. But there are these requirements. At least a quorum of the board must participate in person from a singular physical location clearly identified on the agenda and which is open to the public and situated within the jurisdiction. And then the other one is that members of the public must be provided a means to remotely hear and visually observe the meeting and remotely address the governing board. I know you all do this. You have done this for a while, even under the normal teleconferencing rules. I know when you all had to do this, you did a two-way broadcasting where there's audiovisual, telephonic, and live web casting of the meeting. That's fine. So there also, the agenda has to provide notice of how the members can access the meeting and how they can comment. This is similar to what we have in AB 361 with using the hand-raising feature. Also, if the broadcast is disrupted, just like AB 361, you need to stop, you cannot take action. And then the board, same again, cannot require public comments to be submitted in advance. And then this last bullet point is just kind of weird. The member has to publicly disclose before any action is taken if any individuals 18 or older are present in the room at the remote location, and the general nature of the member's relationship with any such individual. So if you are teleconferencing under AB 2449 from your living room and your husband or wife or spouse or partner is with you, you would have to say that they are in the room and that they are your husband, wife, spouse, etc. So it's just a little bit of an oddity, something that we haven't seen before. Before we go on, I want to make a quick point about the intersection of these various teleconferencing rules. Because as of January 1st, 2023, there are going to be these three completely different ways that you can do teleconferencing. They all have completely different rules, some of which overlap, many of which do not. We have the pre-pandemic teleconferencing rules. Those are those six requirements. Then we have AB 361, our COVID era rules, which does not expire until January 1st, 2024. And then we have this new thing, AB 2449, and they overlap in some respects, but they are not the same. So I would just say be strategic in choosing which route you go. And if there are questions, this is going to just cause a world of confusion, especially if you're 449. I think it's an incredibly onerous bill. And just be strategic and be careful. All right, let's get out of this teleconferencing land for a little bit. Question number three, what are the meeting notice and agenda requirements? So we're not in teleconferencing world anymore. This is just we're normal circumstance for any meeting. What do you have to do? The golden rule is with limited exceptions, if it is not on the agenda, do not talk about the matter. And this bears on transparency and the sunshiny requirements of the Brown Act. The public needs to know what's going to be discussed so that they can respond accordingly. You can't shock them into discussing something that they weren't prepared for. All right, next slide. Oh, here's the technical rule, just real quick. The agenda, of course, shall be posted properly in advance of the meeting. We're going to discuss about what properly means and have to include a brief description of the items to be transacted or discussed. All right. Now, there are some limited exceptions on when the board can discuss a non-agenda item. The first is just an emergency situation, and this is rarely authorized. Think public health emergency, think safety emergency. This is a very rarely applied circumstance. There's also continued matters. I think we got to click one or two times and we'll get them all up on there. There we go. Continued matters, again, this is not something that we advise. Certainly do not do this as a regular practice, but if the agenda was posted from a prior meeting less than 5 days ago and the matter was continued, technically you are allowed to talk about it, but if you're going, you know, you should be reposting the agenda and so it should just be on the new agenda. Next one. You can also give direction to staff. Again, you know, just with all of these, be careful. You can have brief responses. You can ask a clarifying question. You can make an announcement. Again, you know, limit that. And then the fifth one, discussion over future agenda items. I was in a board meeting a few weeks ago and a parent wanted something on the agenda in the future and was actually being very respectful and very nice. And the board handled it wonderfully. You know, they just said, okay, you know, that's something that we can consider on a future agenda and we can actually delve into it. All right, next up. Board interaction with the public on agenda items. Let's talk for a minute about this. So the board may briefly interact with the public on agenda items beyond just receiving input. You know, normally it should just be coming from the public to you and you should just be nodding or even, you know, you can say that's something that we consider in the future. Because the significant board interaction with the public during public comment is not the best practice. It of course could lead to a host of issues. It could lead to discussing non-agenda items. It could lead to board indecision if something new is brought up. So, you know, of course, take public comment as required, but it's ultimately for you all as the board to deliberate and ask questions of staff. And the discussion with public is not required and should be limited if it's exercised at all. These are the possible risks attendant to extensive interaction with the public, some of which I just mentioned. Discussion, it can just lead to topics not on the agenda. It can lead to these like really long, chaotic, inefficient meetings and can just, it risks board indecision and the board just not all being on the same page if one board member is interacting with the public. Next up. Okay, posting requirements. Many of you, all of you, I think, are familiar with these. You have to post the agenda for a regular meeting 72 hours in advance. So 71 hours and 59 minutes is not compliant. It has to be 72 hours. Special meeting, 24 hours. And then emergency meetings, really, really rare. Again, something typically extreme, dire, public health, safety, something that can't even wait for this 24-hour special meeting. Go on. Now, where must the agenda be posted? It has to be physically posted in a publicly accessible location for the entire posting period. So if it's a regular meeting, it has to be up there for the whole 3 days, the whole 72 hours before. It also has to be up on the website, on the homepage with a prominent direct link. And we do see this come up fairly regularly with schools. It's low-hanging fruit for some authorizers who go to some school's website and the agenda is not as readily accessible as it has to be under the law. So just a quick word of caution there. All right, closed session. As I talked about way at the beginning of this, there are six reasons why charter schools can meet in closed session for the purposes of discussing you know, certain items under the Brown Act. That are specifically allowed to be discussed confidentially. We'll talk about that in a second. But of course, the default rule is you are always in open session unless the legislator has provided you with these very specific exceptions of that allow you to meet in closed session. Now, when you do meet in closed session, these are some tips for you. The legislator has included, as you'll see in point one here, this Brown Act safe harbor language. And we call it the safe harbor language because the legislator has essentially said If you use this language, you fill in the blanks, then people can't challenge you in your agenda and claim that that item is sufficient. The board chair must also provide oral notice in advance of closed session. I know you all do that. And that's as simple as the board chair just reading from the agenda, the safe harbor language that's on it. Point three, once you are in closed session, you must make a public report of any action taken. And you have to do so by roll call vote or abstention of every member if there were any. Now, if no action was taken, of course, that's fine. You just report out when you come back into open session that there was no action taken. Next up, this is just a really quick note on executive compensation. The legislator has determined that approval of a CEO or executive director's compensation must occur at a regular, not a special meeting of the board. And the board has to give an oral report that describes all these things listed here, the salary, the benefits, et cetera, essentially to get a sense of how much is this person's total compensation going to be. The idea here is to shine a bright light on it, make it really transparent, ensure that the compensation is fair and not wildly out of proportion to their responsibilities. Again, something I know you all do. Okay, question four, what are the public's rights at meetings? You know, as I said at the beginning, they have a lot of rights. They have, the first is the right to provide public testimony. So while board members cannot talk about items not on the agenda, members of the public can. And one reason they might is they might show up and talk about something because they want you to talk about it at a future meeting, something that we see happen often. There are other rights of the public. They can, if we click, they might show up on our screen here. Yeah, they can tape or broadcast. There's also, you as the board cannot impose rights on conditions on attendance, so they're protected from that. You can't say, for example, you know, show your driver's license in order to come to this meeting, not that you ever would. There's also a right to non-discriminatory facilities, so think of ADA compliance there. And then there's also a right to public writings, agenda packets, materials that relate to open session only. Of course, you do not provide anything that is just for closed session only. And then next up, public testimony issues. This is something that comes up a lot in meetings, and you know, what happens when we have speakers that criticize staff? It is a free speech right for members of the public under the First Amendment of the US Constitution to speak their mind and about the performance of employees. So just because a member of the public is saying something that is perhaps critical or unpleasant, they have the right to do so. Now, as we'll talk about in a little bit, threats are a different story, or at least they can be. But when a member of the public is engaging in critical speech, we must allow that speech to continue. We cannot cut it off. Now, confidentiality requirements, this is kind of the second bullet here, kind of a tricky one. If, for example, an employee speaks and is sharing confidential student or health information that maybe is protected under FERPA or HIPAA, it certainly is within the board's authority and advisable, actually, to remind them, to remind that employee of their duties under the law. But if it's just a member of the public and they're sharing confidential information, that's harder to shut down. The law does not tell us exactly what we can do in a circumstance like that. But we have seen courts recognize that there are limits to the First Amendment. There are limits to acceptable or allowable behavior, even in this very sunshiny, open public forum. But of course, these are very narrow circumstances where we would ever want to shut down public speech. That dovetails actually into this third bullet point about when the public acts in a disruptive manner. We're going to talk in a little bit about a new law that actually addresses this situation more head on. And here is the new law. So this new law, Senate Bill 1100, it was just signed this August, so just a couple of months ago. It provides some clarity on circumstances when the board can act with comfort that the law is behind them. Now, like 2449, it is not effective until January 1st, 2023. So keep that in mind. But essentially, this new law adds a brand new section to the Brown Act. It authorizes the presiding member of the governing board or their designee, if, for example, the board chair is absent, to remove or cause the removal of an individual for disrupting a meeting. Now, let's define disrupting a meeting, because that's, of course, important to figuring out when you are legally able to remove them. And I think that's up on the next slide. So disrupting means engaging in behavior during a meeting of a legislative body that actually disrupts. So it's impeding, it's rendering the meeting infeasible, you cannot continue. And it could include either of the following. It could be a failure to comply with reasonable and lawful regulations or policies. So that would be, for example, if you've given the public 2 minutes to speak and somebody keeps talking, they won't stop talking, you can't continue your meeting because they're talking, and you just can't get them to stop. That would be a circumstance there. And then the second one is engaging in a behavior that constitutes use of force or a true threat of force. And one thing that's important about this law generally, and just what actually disrupting means, is that this definition just really codifies the First Amendment principles that we've always been operating under as it relates to the Brown Act. And I think the second one, B, is pretty clear. The use of force is pretty clear. In terms of failure to comply with what's reasonable, this is what I just said. If you're in an in-person meeting context and you have the member of the public who was entitled to speak for 2 minutes and they go well beyond their 2 minutes, and maybe they're yelling and they have been warned, which we'll talk about in a second, that is a legal requirement. They won't cede their time. They won't leave. This is a circumstance that could contemplate removal of the individual. Now, of course, be careful. If somebody's been talking for 2 minutes and 30 seconds, that's not sufficient. You know, I mean, it really has to be impeding your ability to move on. Now, before that removal, there are some requirements. Let's go on. So you have to warn the individual. So they're going way, way over their time. You have to warn them, okay, if you don't stop talking, if you don't cede your time, I'm going to have to have you leave the meeting. You have to say that they're disrupting the meeting and that their failure to cease any whatever behavior they're doing might result in their removal. After that warning, after you've said those things, the presiding member or the designee can remove the individual or cause their removal if they don't promptly cease their behavior. Now, I will say just one thing really fast. On the threat of force, the warning requirement does not apply. And that's intended to, again, comport with the constitutional limit under the First Amendment, which does not allow you as a person to be put into danger by someone else's First Amendment rights. So that's the new law. It helps protect the board and your meetings. But let's move on to closed session. So I've mentioned this a couple times. These are the six reasons why a board can meet in closed session. I read these for you earlier. Personnel, which is broadly just appointment, employment, evaluation, discipline, dismissal, or release. Yeah, there's six of an employee. Real estate negotiations, labor negotiations. There you might be discussing compensation or benefits that you don't want publicly available at that time. Because they haven't been made final. For conference with legal counsel, this can be both anticipated or existing litigation, public security issues, and finally, pupil discipline. And you'll see a common theme here. We see like with personnel and pupil discipline, we're meeting in closed session to protect rights of privacy and confidentiality. With some of these other ones like real estate negotiations and labor negotiations, those are included there so that with the idea that it's all about getting the best deal for the taxpayer. So if you're negotiating an open session and you're saying non-confidentially that this is our low bar, you know, then that's going to be the bar. You're not going to be able to get the best deal. Now let's on the next slide talk about confidentiality, what it means. We have here what happens in closed session, it stays in closed session. No board member, staff member, or invitee may disclose any information from a closed session without authorization of the board. So you cannot tell your spouse, you cannot tell your best friend, you cannot tell a member of the school staff or anyone who is not actually part of that session without authorization from your board in advance. All right, next one. These are the penalties and remedies for violations of the Brown Act. And one thing that's really important to know is that if a violation is found, a court can actually come in and declare the resulting action by the board null and void. And, you know, so that's a serious ramification. Injunctive relief may also be obtained, and the prevailing party can get attorney's fees. These things are why we work really hard when a school does get a notice of a Brown Act violation to cure that violation so that the school doesn't get sued. Criminal penalties, as you'll see in number two here, could also apply, although it's not too often that we'll see a district attorney pursuing something like this. It has happened on occasion over the years, predominantly though, when the school is in the news for a variety of other things. There's also a risk, there's also a risk of charter revocation because of course, compliance with the law is an area in which your authorizer is responsible for ensuring. And we'll talk actually a bit about revocation in the second section that we have here coming in just a few weeks on November 1st. They being your authorizer in this case, can issue a notice to you and demand that you cure any legal violation of the Brown Act. There's also the risk of stakeholder trust being harmed if they feel like things are being done that are not above board or that the board is not operating transparently. This, of course, can lead to issues down the line. All right, let's talk about in the next slide, if you do get into a circumstance where somebody is going to send you a notice and a demand for cure, generally you're going to have 30 days to respond to that notice. So generally the written demand for the alleged open session violations must be made within 30 days as well. So that's an important point. They can't go back, 2 years to a Brown Act violation by, reading or watching the video. Otherwise the demand must be made within 90 days. There's some exceptions there. And like I just said, I think what's most important for you all is that if we just click, I think it'll pop up. You generally have 30 days to respond to that notice. We recommend that you do whatever you need to do to cure the violation. For example, the agenda was not sufficiently descriptive on an item, we suggest that you actually go back, repost an agenda with the appropriate descriptor, bring the board together, and then vote on the action again. It's just really not worth the cost and expense of potential litigation. If especially because attorney's fees can be involved, it just, to do something that is fairly easy to cure. So with that, actually, this is, I believe, the end of your Brown Act training. And as I said, on November 1st, we'll come back together and talk about a whole other host of issues. As Paul mentioned earlier, we've got conflict of interest, we've got charter renewal, we've got revocation, we've got case law. There's a lot more to come then. But I think that is all for now. And I'll turn it over to Paul for a couple of final words.
Thanks, Kayla, for building the momentum for next session for really exciting stuff. Anyway, well, if there are any questions regarding everything we covered this morning, I know that's a lot of material to throw at you. All important information for you to have access to. The recording, the video will be present, we'll distribute afterwards. if there's anybody that either missed it or would like to go back and look at anything, but we're certainly here to answer any questions. I know we've got a couple minutes still left in the morning.
Paul, I just wanted to go back to that AB2449. And I know the AB361 is expiring. I think I heard Kayla said that the 2024. And there is a traditional normal teleconference meeting as expressed in the SSP bylaws. We have that. And so in the event, because that AB2449, you have to meet two conditions, which is personal emergency to the board. So we can continue the practice of the regular normal teleconference as provided in the bylaws and in the Brown Act, so long as we comply to that six requirements, which is posting the agenda, putting the addresses of the participants in the agenda, ADA compliance to the site where the board member will be, and comply with that, and then also ensuring that majority of the participants participating in the teleconference are in the jurisdiction of the charter school, such as for SSP, it's San Diego County. We are good to continue.
Correct.
Absolutely. Thank you.
I would anticipate, you look what they're doing, they're tinkering with the Brown Act, they're recognizing the confluence of technology and open meetings. In the pandemic has changed people's perspective on how meetings can be held, how the public can access meetings. So I would anticipate that we're going to continue to see, broadened. There are, First Amendment rights groups that are pushing the legislature for broader access to meetings. I would not be surprised to see if we are mandated soon to require all of our meetings to be live streamed, with the ability of people to participate via Zoom or some technology, even if everybody was meeting in person. And you notice it's interesting because some large school districts, while they had a lot of interaction with the public during the pandemic because they were meeting virtually, immediately shut it down and went to in-person meetings and stopped doing virtual meetings, which was, I thought, was very strange because they were making it hard for the public to meet with them. They had to travel long distances. It was San Diego's big district, Oakland, LAUSD, et cetera, huge districts. So I honestly think there's going to be some continued changes in the law around how you all are able to meet and how members of the public are able to witness and participate in those meetings.
Maybe they did it on purpose, Paul.
Oh no, I've listened in. I've heard them pretty much say that they were tired of Zoom, which we all are, but they were also tired. Frankly, some of the school districts admitted they were tired of the level of public participation.
Public participation
that Zoom meetings gave access to people. Right. Yeah.
You don't want, if you don't want public opinion, just don't ask for it.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you for the time this morning.
Okay, and thank you very much to you both for taking the time to put all this together. This is a very important part of participating in a board, knowing what our limitations are, more importantly, understanding how our behavior affects the organization that we actually serve for. And this clearly outlines some new rules, and some we'll have to talk about a little bit offline. And make sure that we can remain and continue to be in compliance. Moving on then, if I don't hear any more, I wanna thank all the board members. I understand that everybody's confirmed their attendance and participation for part two of this workshop training. Please note on your calendar that part two of the board workshop is to be conducted on Tuesday, November the 1st from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m., okay?
All right.
Everybody got that? All right. The next item on the agenda is actually adjournment. So do I have a motion to adjourn the meeting?
Motion to adjourn, Morton.
Thank you. Do I have a second?
Second, Barton.
Very good. We will conduct a voting roll call for the adjournment. Myself is aye. Scott?
Aye.
David?
Aye.
Tim?
Aye.
And Eric?
Aye.
Okay, great, everybody.